For decades, the academic fight over housing politics has had two big antagonists: the home voter, who treats land use as wealth defense, and the NIMBY, who just doesn't want change, especially nearby. But there's a newer strand of work that asks a more uncomfortable question. What if a lot of housing opposition is neither pocketbook nor proximity, but aesthetic judgment and symbolic cues? My guest today is Chris Elmendorf. He's a law professor at the University of California, Davis, and a prominent pro-housing researcher and commentator. These different explanations aren't just stories that academics tell. Each one implies a different fix and a different diagnosis of what's actually blocking construction. If it's home voters, you're up against property value anxiety and cartel politics. If it's NIMBYism, distance and process design are everything. But if people are largely reacting to fit, to whether a five-story building matches the streetscape, to whether it reads as tasteful or tacky, to whether luxury or developer triggers disgust, then the terrain shifts. Because fit isn't just a private preference, it's a public language that can launder a lot of different anxieties. And it's a kind of politics that doesn't totally melt away just because the economic case for more housing is strong. It also helps explain why some reforms that seem technocratically obvious can still face intense resistance. You're not only arguing about rent levels, you're arguing about what a neighborhood is for and what a city should look like. The evidence we're going to focus on today comes from experiments that hold the project constant and vary the signals. Nearby versus far away, apartments versus offices, award-winning architect versus infamously bad one, and even pretty versus ugly facades. Chris's research has real implications for where pro-housing coalitions can win and where they'll keep running into a wall. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives in conversation over the most important issues of the day. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So you have a very interesting new paper, which comes in a line of interesting new papers that are about why people oppose housing and has to do a lot with aesthetics and symbols. But I want to first start with what I think are pre-existing beliefs about why people don't like new housing, either near them or new housing development in general. What does the political science literature tell us already about this problem?
So I would say there are two dominant explanations for why people oppose housing development. There's an explanation associated with Bill Fischel, the economist, which came to be known as the home voter hypothesis. And the home voter hypothesis supposes that people who own homes are very anxious about their property values. And they're going to oppose any change in their neighborhood or elsewhere that they think might adversely affect their property values. And renters are kind of checked out. They're not really engaged because they don't have as much stake in housing policy. And then there's a second theory, which is sometimes called NIMBYism, that says maybe people are concerned about property values, maybe they're concerned about something else, but the fundamental thing is that people don't want change in their immediate neighborhood. So the NIMBY theory doesn't distinguish so clearly between homeowners and renters. What it does is it distinguishes between projects that are nearby and projects that are farther away. And so the NIMBY theory holds that the same project, if it's proposed 10 miles from one's home, one's going to be indifferent to it, whether one's a homeowner or a renter. But if it's proposed right next door or very nearby, one's going to oppose it because one doesn't like change in one's neighborhood.
And these things are sort of related, right? Like, of course, if you were a home voter and you were concerned about property values, in most instances, I mean, people aren't doing, I think, sophisticated like econometric analysis when they're thinking about this. They're usually concerned about like, okay, if some shitty apartment building with a bunch of working class people move into my neighborhood, that will reduce my property values. They're not like thinking through the economics of it. So in some ways, like the home voter hypothesis is like also localized, right?
Well, it could be. I mean, in the sense that most housing politics has traditionally been localized, the home voter hypothesis, as Fischel originally articulated, was also focused on changes nearby. But going back to the 1970s, there's been debate about whether It would be better to make housing policy at regional or statewide levels rather than locally or land use policy at these larger scales. And one argument against doing land use policy at a higher level of government is that it would allow homeowners to act as a cartel, because you could use that homeowner coalition to control not just local amenities or disamenities from a particular project, but the total supply of housing within a regional market.
So you have like been involved in like housing advocacy and politics and policy for a long time, and not just in the like academic sense, but also in just being involved in what's going on in California and in San Francisco and the Bay Area writ large. Like from your own personal experiences, when you come across people who are opposing housing, or when you talk to elected officials about why people oppose housing, are there versions of these theories that are most common that they point to? I guess in my experience, like when I talk to elected officials or I'm talking to people who are activists in communities, et cetera, like the things that usually come up are things around parking. Like people are really upset about the idea of losing parking, about there being congestion. They're very concerned about overcrowding in schools as like a very like tangible thing that might happen if more people move in. And they are concerned about the like developers making money aspect of it. Like they don't like the idea of developers making a bunch of money because either they have an association of developers as being corrupt, or they have some sorts of like anti-capitalist views in some of these more left-wing cities. So these are the types of things that I often come across. And these are sort of like a mix of both of these. And also, I think in some ways, some of the research we'll get into that you've done as well. But it's not like a clean story often about like either NIMBYism or home voter hypothesis.
Yeah, I think those are definitely common refrains. In San Francisco, nobody's concerned about overcrowding of schools. The concern goes the other way. And yeah. I think that will be increasingly true in many other areas of the country. There's definitely concern about heights and buildings that are too tall and buildings that don't fit in. If you go back to the heydays of anti-growth activism in the Bay Area in the 1970s and 1980s, it was like, don't Manhattanize San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And there's concerns about views to the water and views to historical neighborhoods. So I think it really is a mishmash of considerations.
And one thing that's really hard in the like journalist space, when there's not been like a ton of high quality research trying to really tease apart these concerns, is that you're often like forced to think about how seriously to take what someone is saying, right? Because like, the thing is, like, people often have like some reason why they've decided to oppose something or they dislike something. And sometimes they're not even just lying. It's like very difficult to know why you believe something or don't. Like it's not always like fully accessible to even you level. And then they're trying to explain. And like this happens a lot of times, like, I mean, on Twitter and social media all the time, where like you will debunk one argument and then the person will start coming up with other reasons why they still disagree. And I don't think it's like a, I mean, maybe it's in part that people don't like to admit they're wrong or whatever it is. Like, I'm sure there's something like that playing into it. But like, it's often really, really difficult for me when I'm like interacting with someone and I'm interviewing them and I'm like, okay, so like you say you're opposed to this housing or community, like, why is that? And it's almost like you're asking them to come up with reasons in the form of logic when that may not actually be how they're doing it. And so a lot of the prevalence of like, oh, it's because of property values, oh, it's because of this, is because smart people, often highly educated people, are being asked to come up with reasons that feel like reasonable to someone they're talking to. And instead of just being like, I don't like tall buildings, I don't really like cities. And, you know, and so like, I wonder how much that biases our understanding.
And there's two ways in which social science tries to think about causation. One way is to say, of the different views or beliefs that a person has, like which one is driving their behavior or identities. And the second way social scientists talk about causation is if we change some element of something that is out there in the world, maybe that's a policy, maybe that's a housing development, maybe that's, you know, could be anything else, changing that feature of that thing from A to B, does that increase or decrease support or political behavior or consumer behavior on the part of a human being? And that second form of causation is actually more easier to analyze and maybe even a more coherent concept. Because, like, if you wanted to understand how an identity or a belief actually affects behavior, you would need some way to change that identity or belief without changing anything else about the person. And that's like really hard to do, right? You can do things that change people's beliefs. You can expose them to new information, but you can never be sure that in changing that belief that is the thing that you are interested in, you're not also changing something else.
Yeah.
And then there's some things that are like literally impossible to change. Like people talk all the time about, does race cause certain forms of behavior? Well, to really answer that question, you would need to know how, you know, I would behave if I were Black, or Jerusalem would behave if she were white. And like, what does that even mean?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And at what point, like, you changed me to white right now versus did I grow up as like, just so many things that are difficult there. So the line of work that you and your co-authors, who are also friends of the argument, Josh Kalla and David Brockman, have been doing is around this idea of aesthetics. I think broadly, I'm going to just refer to all of it as that, even though I think there's some nuance in some of the work you've done there. And what started you thinking that this was like an underappreciated reason for why people would oppose or support housing in their communities?
So there's two things that got us thinking about this. First, we had these results in a working paper that we posted a year ago that showed that people's feelings about cities, like, do you feel warm or cold towards cities? Do you like cities or do you not like cities? That is strongly associated with support for allowing more apartment buildings to be constructed. And so what part of our question was like, well, what is this thing that people like or dislike about cities? Maybe it's actually the tall buildings themselves, or maybe it's something else. But there might be something like, there might be some kind of like aesthetic response to the diversity or the hustle and bustle of the city, or just the cityscapes. Like, some people like mountains, maybe some people also like tall buildings as just visual interest in the on the horizon.
Like, quick aside here, I was on Ezra's Klein's podcast talking about this kind of issue, and at one point he just says to me, oh, like, Jerusalem, like, no, like, nobody feels the awe of when they look at a city in the same way as when they look at a mountain. I'm like, Ezra, I think that's just some people feel some ways and some people feel other ways.
So I actually love mountains and I love cities, and
I have a
very similar reaction to being in the Sierra versus being in Manhattan. Like, there's this magnificence of the variation of the horizon, the play of light off the mountains or the buildings, and I don't know. And so maybe I'm just weird in that way, but
probably.
But then the other thing is that people complain all the time that, and you hear it in, you know, just anecdotally in the newspaper or at public meetings about development, people complain, oh, that's so ugly, or, oh, new buildings are ugly, or it doesn't fit the character. And to be honest, like, I tended to view those arguments, or tend to suppose they were pretextual, that something else was going on. Maybe you were actually concerned about like social change in the community rather than one building being ugly. Or maybe you were concerned about property values. You're anxious about quote gentrification leading to rising rents, and that the complaints about buildings being ugly weren't really real complaints. So it was the combination of those two things that pushed us to probe this a little further.
So I want to talk about a little bit about that older paper first, about symbols and how they drive attitudes towards housing. I had your co-author David Brockman on my old show, Good on Paper, to talk about this, but I'm hoping you can kind of just summarize the details of that for us first. I think that helps inform this new paper we're going to talk about.
Yeah. The basic idea of that paper is that there's a lot of evidence in political science that most people don't think really deeply about policy. They're not wonkish people like us. And they may have things that they generally want to change about the world. Like, they might like to have higher incomes, or they might like to, you know, have less poverty or other things. But like, to actually do that kind of cause and effect reasoning and understand what policy change would deliver the things that they want is kind of hard. And so they may rely on easy heuristics if those are available. They may just like have associations between things they think of as good or bad in the world. And if a policy seems to have some connection to that good or bad thing, they'll support or oppose it on the basis of that of that connection. So in the housing context, I think a really clear example of that is that there's a lot of distrust of developers. Developers are seen as greedy, as manipulative, as often corrupt. When they're in the news, they're either proposing to change your community or they're in handcuffs going off to jail for, you know, bribing a city council member.
Especially in Los Angeles, Jesus.
Especially in Los Angeles, right? So if someone says like, oh, you know, here's a developer, they're going to get rich off that project. Well, maybe you don't understand much else about the project, but you don't like the idea of the developer getting rich. And and so you'll oppose the project because you see the developer getting rich. Another example is class resentments. So it turns out that some people like feel just fine as measured by a feeling thermometer, which is a conventional way that political scientists measure affects towards different groups. Some people are like, rich people, they're fine. Poor people, they're fine. I don't know. Or some people like feel bad about poor people or negative towards them. Some people feel negative towards rich people. So it turns out that people who feel negative towards rich people are really, really, really opposed to new apartment buildings when they are described as luxury apartments. Whereas people who feel like indifferent towards rich people, they don't care whether the new apartments are luxury apartments or apartments that are met at the normal rate for new construction. They're just not responsive to that argument.
Is one way of thinking about this theory that people have to use heuristics in general to determine their support or opposition for policies? And I mean, like, because I think, you know, someone listening to this might think, well, like, okay, we're just saying like voters are stupid and that they just can't even analyze like basics of ideas. But it's also, I think it's like less actually pejorative than that. It's more that like, you're not going to become an expert in every single policy issue. It's like both literally impossible to do that as a practical matter, but also just like not actually a good use of your time given the, you know, maybe potential marginal impact that you might have in this space. And so like, you need to develop like shortcuts for ways of figuring out your support or opposition for different things when they do come up. And people do this in a lot of ways. Like one way they do it is like they have trusted messengers. Like, so if you're someone who really supported Barack Obama, you hear him come out in favor of a policy, maybe you're now warming up to that idea. You think, okay, that's part of the tent of what it means to be, you know, an Obama liberal. Or like, I really like Bernie Sanders, or like Donald Trump. Like these are ways that people determine they like something. And like, often I think that in the general political commentariat, like when you see public opinion shifting because like Trump said something or, you know, Biden said something or something like that, like it's seen as like, oh, look how dumb and polarized our politics are. But I'm like, I actually think it's not an insane heuristic to decide like I trust certain people. And like when they tell me that something is good or bad, I will like tend to believe them until I stop trusting them. Like that seems like actually like not irrational.
Yeah. And there's a big debate that's sort of unresolved about to what extent people responding to these symbols are responding instrumentally with respect to some well-defined policy goal, and to what extent it's a kind of like emotional, unreasoned response. And I think that debate is kind of impossible to resolve.
Which way would you like kind of err?
I think there's evidence of both. Like people do respond emotionally to things that disgust them or that appeal to them. And if, you know, the idea of some kind of shady group like developers getting rich off something, that elicits an emotional reaction. And if you don't have any better argument to go on, then you'll go on the basis of that reaction. But at the same time, in other work, I've shown that this is work with Clayton Ollens, Dana Klobziger. I've shown that exposing people to short videos that explain the connection between new housing supply and the availability and affordability of existing housing, that has huge effects on support for new market rate development. So that's a clear example of people reasoning instrumentally relative to their goals on the basis of new information. Now, what we haven't done is put that together with also messages about those greedy developers. And I think that an interesting question is like when those two kinds of information are made equally salient, like what are people going to respond to? And I wish I had a good answer for you, but I don't.
And part of what's so interesting about persuasion in this space is that usually at like the national level with issues that are super, you know, well debated, something like abortion or immigration, et cetera, like it's hard to move people a lot in the course of an election unless, you know, facts on the ground are changing significantly, because people have heard all of the arguments largely. Like they've been inundated by interest groups, by newspapers, by politician ads, et cetera. But at the local level, like you know, if one group decides to put a bunch of money behind like one ad campaign, it's not necessarily true that it will be matched by like another group doing the opposite, because there's so little money in local politics relative to what, you know, the impact of these policies are, but also just relative to like national politics. And so it is an interesting place to see like how much persuasion can happen when people have less formed views, or at least less views that have been less influenced by public reasoning.
Yeah, David and Josh have another paper on where do campaign effects matter. And one of their findings in that work is that, yeah, partisan general elections, you want to, those things are, there's very little marginal benefit from spending in those. But if you're a local or a nonpartisan election, that's where your messages can really travel.
With your first paper, and I mean, to me, I also had the biggest thing I thought about with that was about what to do about the developer problem, because you can't actually like, you can't like say like, okay, well now we're going to build housing without any developers. I mean, like it's possible to imagine like there'd be more public developers, et cetera. But in general, especially in the short to medium term, the vast majority of housing in this country is going to be built by private developers. Especially if we're going to like ramp up significantly in a way that would address the housing crisis. And like, I actually wasn't sure what to do with this, because they're like, my first instinct was like, okay, right now I find that developers are like way too cautious about getting involved in public debates, because they get so much backlash, either rightly or wrongly, when they do show up to these meetings. They try to like hire someone else to actually stand up there because they don't want to be involved in it. They try to like, you know, do a bunch of behind the scenes work because they really, really don't enjoy public facing stuff because they get a lot of backlash. And I think that actually like encourages a lot of feelings that the entire process is shady, and that like probably we would be served better if developers were just like more open about what they were doing and why, and like explaining themselves in public more clearly. But then like I'm also just like, maybe just like even more awareness of developers as part of this is like a bad thing. So I don't know, what did you take away from this?
We did a extension of that work, and then we've now posted it, in which we expose people to short videos of an actual real world developer who was in these videos, like either just explaining how she got into the work, a little bit about her personal background, her volunteer activities, you know, stuff that's totally unrelated to the actual housing development process. And in another video, she explains like, this is kind of how projects get financed. This is how it works. These are who the investors are. And these videos did actually change both people's views about developers and their support for allowing developers to build housing in their neighborhoods. The effect sizes aren't huge, but they're real and they're statistically significant. And it's only exposure to one relatively short video. So I think there's the possibility of humanizing developers over the course of time. But I also think that the reality is that we've set up project approval processes that are highly discretionary and that give local elected officials who are elected in very low profile elections where money goes a big distance, like an incentive to do kind of shady things with the developers. And so it's not surprising that developers from time to time appear in the news in handcuffs. And I think so long as they are appearing in the news in handcuffs from time to time, it's going to be hard to rehabilitate their image as a class.
I mean, even putting aside when they do like actual crimes, the actual like legal process of getting a permit often like sounds very like legalized corruption. And like, I remember I was talking to someone who was what they call themselves kind of like a developer of last resort in the city that they worked in, where like the city would kind of come to them about a lot where they're like, there's so much opposition here, we don't know what to do. Like, can you, whatever. Like that's how they thought about their work in large part. And they were telling me that literally that their first step is to just like get in names and of all the institutions and individuals who are likely to be a problem and go around and essentially meet with these people and figure out like, are there things that we could just do about this project to like make you happy about it? So like,
Right.
does your niece play soccer? I mean, this is like a, I think this didn't really happen. This is kind of like a facetious example, but like, does your niece play soccer? Well, like, we'll just put a soccer field like on the new property. Or like, we'll just fund this new, like, you know, this rec league in the area. And in some ways, like this stuff can sound good. Like, oh, it's great. The community's extracting value from these developers. But in others, it's like, we're saying that like the people who are the most connected get to like, basically dictate how the project works because maybe they're rich and then also the developers themselves. It just seems like, oh, so there is actually more added value you could be giving to the community. You're just, why are you forcing us to pull it out of you? And it actually increases the likelihood of you feeling like they're trying to keep something from you or that they're being shady. And in general, I mean, this is something that you've talked about a lot, but like many people who are in the Yes in My Backyard movement have been really focused on is like these discretionary processes instead of having standardization of just saying like a good project looks like X, you will get approved if you do X. And like
Right.
then everyone agrees. Like that's a very like straightforward, everyone understands what's going on, doesn't feel shady way versus like, oh, well, this project's gonna look like Y. Okay, fine, we fought them. Now they're gonna give you also this park and this whatever. It's like, oh, you're a bad person. You could have given that to me all along.
Right. And if you have the standardized rules that are spelled out in advance, if people don't like them, they at least know who to go to change it, right? You go to your city
Yes.
council and you say, change the rules. Whereas if what gets built is happening through this discretionary process, and the developer paid off that group, but they didn't pay off that group, then it really looks like it's the developer who's the one who's to blame,
Totally.
as much as it is the city.
So I want to get into your new paper now. So the gist of the paper is that opposition to new housing is driven in part, in maybe in large part, by people's aesthetic judgments. How did you guys discover this? What experiments did you run? Like, how did you find this out?
So we approach this from two directions. One is that we look at the attitudes that people say they hold and how those attitudes correlate with their support for allowing five-story apartment buildings to be built in existing cities in areas where they're relatively uncontroversial, like along existing commercial corridors. And the second thing we do is experiments where we propose a hypothetical project and we vary attributes of that hypothetical project, including where it would be located. In one of the experiments, whether the architect of the project won an award for especially wonderful or especially horrible work. And in a third experiment, we present pictures of the project. And we use pictures that we pre-tested, and we found that these are all of five-story apartment buildings that either people thought were really pretty or really ugly. We also, in one of the experiments, varied whether the proposal was for a five-story apartment building or a five-story office building to try to get at, like, well, if the opposition to apartments is really about opposition to poor people or opposition to whatever, the type of people who are believed to live in apartment buildings, then you would expect that office buildings of the same size would be more popular. And the things that people say, like aesthetically, like I think, for example, one of the questions we used was, do you think new apartment buildings are ugly? Another question was, do you think cities would look nicer with fewer tall apartment buildings? That those types of beliefs, if they're pretextual, they wouldn't predict opposition to office buildings rather relative to apartments.
And walk us through some of the actual findings, because I want to get a sense of like how big the effect sizes are here for some of these experiments.
Okay, so maybe I'll take a step back and I'll start with our motivating example. So the motivating example was just a question about would you support a law or do you support a law that would allow five-story apartment buildings to be constructed along major streets and in commercial areas? So this is the type of state law that has been passed in California, in Montana, in Texas, in Florida, right? There are a lot of states that are saying, like, let's allow apartment buildings to be built in areas that are now just commercial uses. So some of those also extend to major streets. And if your view of housing politics is that people are mostly NIMBYs, then you would expect that the opposition to that policy would be strongest among people who live along a major street or in a commercial area. So but earlier in the survey, we asked people where they lived. Mm-hmm. And then we subset the data by whether people live along a major street in a commercial area, whether they live within walking distance of a major street or a commercial area, or whether they live within driving distance of the nearest major street or commercial area. And it turns out the people who are the most supportive of this policy are the people who live in the along the major streets and in the commercial areas. So like, that's kind of weird. If you think that people are basically NIMBYs, and it suggests that like there's some kind of selection process where the people who choose to live in these relatively bustling areas are just like more okay with bustle in the form of new development or taller apartment buildings than people who live elsewhere. We also then asked a similar question where we varied whether the proposal was for allowing new apartments just along major streets or in commercial areas, or new apartments in all residential areas, including neighborhoods of single-family homes. And everybody, regardless of where you live, is more opposed to allowing new five-story apartment buildings everywhere, including neighborhoods of single-family homes, than along the commercial streets. So why would a person who lives along a commercial street, again, if like NIMBYism is your motivating theory of housing politics, why mm-hmm. would a person who lives along a commercial street or a major street or commercial area, why would they be more opposed to development in other neighborhoods, right, than just yeah. upzoning their street or their kind of place? So something else is going on. And we think a big part of that something else is aesthetic taste, which both in some respects differ across people. So we do see big variations in the sample as a whole as to whether people think cities would look nicer with fewer tall apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, there are recurring patterns that seem on average to hold across all people, which is a preference for aesthetic similarity between new development and existing buildings nearby.
So one thing that I think is really important to note here is that believing that aesthetic judgments hold a lot of power in determining whether people will oppose or support different kinds of housing legislation or different housing developments in their community doesn't actually mean you're saying that you don't think that NIMBYism or home voter hypothesis have any role at all. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. And in fact, we have evidence for NIMBYism in our study.
Yeah. Can you maybe rank these things for us? Like,
So one of the questions we use where we give people a scenario with a proposed development. It's like, so I think the scenario was, imagine you have an older vacant house. A developer wants to tear it down and replace it with a five-story apartment building. Would you support this project? And in one version of that question, it's proposed for your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And another version, it's proposed for a neighborhood like yours somewhere across the country. And people are more supportive of the project when it's proposed in a neighborhood like yours somewhere across the country. There's like a 5 percentage point increase in support. But we also vary whether the neighborhood is proposed in a neighborhood like yours somewhere across the country versus in a neighborhood that has existing five-story buildings somewhere across the country, right? Mm-hmm. That's a measure of consistency between the proposed project and the existing buildings nearby. That has twice as big of an effect as mm-hmm. varying whether it's the respondent's neighborhood versus a similar neighborhood somewhere across the country. And then we vary whether the architect is an architect who won an award for great residential construction or won an award for atrocious residential construction. These are real architects.
Is that a real award?
Who won real awards. Yes, all truthful information provided in this study. Yeah. And the architect effect is mm-hmm. twice as big as the proximity effect.
Wow.
So The context effects seem to be real. The architect's effects seem to be real and substantial, bigger than mm-hmm. the proximity effect.
Were you surprised by this? Did you think it was going to be this big?
A little bit surprised. I really wasn't sure. I don't think any of us were sure. We were just kind of curious and poking at this and kind of wondering what was going on. And it turns out, like, you know, there is some other work that has been done specifically on building heights. Mm-hmm. There's a really nice paper by Larsen and Nyholt, who were two Danish political scientists, where they vary the height of a proposed development as well as its distance from the respondent. Mm-hmm. They show the location of a project on a map, and they show that people react pretty negatively to high buildings, and that but there's not opposition to high buildings where there are other high buildings or five-story buildings in the area where the project is proposed. But in their design, they're not able to really distinguish whether that result of people being okay with five-story buildings where they're near existing five-story buildings is due to the kind of people who've chosen to live near five-story buildings. Because again, they're showing people projects in relation to where you live now, showing people projects on a map, or whether it's due to the context effect, meaning people like everywhere being cool, regardless of their, you know, having selected into a neighborhood with a lot of buildings, people everywhere being cool with five-story buildings that kind of match the streetscape.
Yeah, I really like that study in part because I enjoy that there are studies about NIMBYism or opposition to housing in other countries, mm-hmm. because I think sometimes people talk about as if like this is just a purely American phenomenon, which kind of leads them away from the institutional solutions that we're talking about here. Like there's NIMBYism and NIMBYist attitudes like everywhere in the world. Like the question is like, how are those mediated by the political institutions that you have? But the thing I thought that was interesting about this is that like in their study, they find that people don't report that taller buildings cause much more congestion or attract more undesirable residents, but they do say that tall buildings don't fit. And like this to me is like very interesting because that's kind of like a direct example of pushing back around the idea that people just don't like certain kinds of people in apartments. I will say that I think that probably in Europe, it's like a different sort of association people have with apartment buildings. Like in the United States, we have like a pretty long history at like both the legal and political level of denigrating people who live in multifamily housing, whereas urban form and development happened very differently in many parts of Europe where rich people often did live in multifamily housing. And so it didn't have the same kinds of associations. But I did think that was like the fact that they didn't think tall buildings cause more congestion, at least, is, I think, quite interesting for people who are, you know, convinced that you could just solve the housing problem if you dealt with the parking issue, right. Which I think is a pretty dominant view within the YIMBY community.
Yeah. And we tried to address that parking issue in our study as well. We, mm-hmm. In one of these proposals, we randomized whether people would be allowed to park on the street, like existing residents in the neighborhood, whether the new residents would be banned from parking on the street, or whether the new residents would be banned from owning cars.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that there's, at least per this study, there's no payoff to banning new residents from parking on the street. At least we couldn't distinguish that statistically from the reference condition of just letting new residents park like anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a negative payoff from banning new residents from owning cars, which we think is also a symbolic politics type result. Like people think like, oh, cars are, I like cars, right? Like most Americans like cars.
I also hope that like, that's also I don't think you should ban people from owning cars, which seems like a, you know, liberal intuition that people hold.
Yeah. So people don't like that. People don't like that. And maybe, and we show, we ask people whether they think the project's going to cause congestion. And we show these two parking restrictions do in fact change people's beliefs about whether the project's going to cause congestion, but they don't increase support for the project.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one meta comment I'll make about all of this is that it's not like, you know, in many ways, it's probably said something good about people that they're like, oh, I think certain kinds of aesthetics are good or bad. And so even if I don't live somewhere, I think it'd be good if they had better aesthetics. Like it's kind of like a nice thing that they care. But it is sort of bizarre. So I want to take a step back here because One thought I had about when reading your paper and trying to think about how it should impact how, you know, politicians or advocates do housing policy and politics is that it's not super relevant what the average person thinks about why housing is good or bad, because the average person is just not involved in housing politics like at all. Like there's a very small handful of people who are involved in local government and at that even beyond that involved in local permitting decisions or who are going to get mad enough to say something about you know, some development happening in their community, et cetera. And part of this is just that like people are just not going to go and advocate against or for new housing happening even 50 miles away from them. That's just like not a thing that like most people are going to do. So like you're automatically inherently kind of just like really only going to be working in the sphere of people who are upset nearby a project to some extent. And then the second thing is just that like I wonder if you were able to look at whether people who are more politically engaged have, you know, different kinds of reasons to be opposed to new housing. Because what I would imagine is that, like, if you have like serious concerns about your, like, you're about to sell your house in a couple of years or whatever it is, or you're already concerned about an apartment building in your community because, you know, you don't like the people who live there, whatever it is, that, like, you're gonna have like really, really strong, you know, incentives to engage in local politics and engage in opposition to that new housing development. And while whereas people who have aesthetic judgments, yeah, maybe that's driving what they think, but like, are you really going to go and like do anything about the fact that an ugly apartment building might show up? Like, you know what I mean? So how
So
did you guys think about this?
this is a really, really, really important question. And I don't think we have a great answer for it here. And I think the most we can say about those people who do participate in public meetings and whether aesthetics matter to them is that there's a new paper. I don't know if it's been posted yet, but it was just presented at a conference by a couple econ PhD students at Stanford, Olivia Martin, and I'm forgetting her co-author's name, where they have used large language models to encode information from the video transcripts of public meetings, like all public meetings that have been held in 150 California cities for the last dozen years or so.
Wow.
It's an amazing project. And they find that when there's a development proposal, the most commonly voiced concern is aesthetics. That's like the number one topic of discussion. So that's some evidence that the peculiar people who do show up at public meetings or who are highly engaged in these issues maybe are not that different from the ordinary people who don't show up. But I think that it's well really hard to sample from and to identify like who is a member of that population of the highly politically engaged. That's like a great frontier for future research. Another thing that I did, and we didn't do it in this paper, but in another paper, I gave survey respondents an opportunity to write their state legislature, thinking that that would be a way of capturing some form of willingness to incur costs. You're not getting paid any extra to do this thing on the survey, and we wanted to see if people who elected to do that had preferences that differed from people who didn't, and we didn't really see like any marked difference in their preferences. On the other hand, like the typical person wrote like 17 words. It's not really clear that that was cap that that opportunity was like experienced in the way in the same way that like I don't know someone who actually takes the time on their own to send the message. Anyway,
You would
that's a
have to have
great
like
question.
such, yeah, you'd have to have such a massive survey to get enough people who have engaged in local politics to
Right.
make sure that
And
the, yeah.
people will misreport that too. We
Yeah.
know that voting is overreported. So it's a great question and a very hard to study question too.
So, but you do offer some, I guess it's recommendations for how people should use your evidence to think through future policies, in part because I think that you are thinking about how to ameliorate concerns around aesthetics. So can you talk us through those recommendations?
So I think one recommendation that's pretty straightforward, though maybe disappointing to many YIMBYs, is that housing advocates should be focusing their efforts on trying to upzone and facilitate development in areas where there already are apartment buildings or where most of the uses are commercial rather than residential. And the neighborhoods that are residential and have a consistent character or style of development are the neighborhoods mm-hmm. where new housing development of the apartment or taller, denser forms is most likely to elicit resistance, and not just resistance from people who live in those neighborhoods, but other people, like the people who live along commercial quarters, the people who live in city centers, who'd be like, oh, why are you doing that? Like, that doesn't mm-hmm. really make sense to me. So I would describe the YIMBY movement over the last decade as having these two great impulses. The one great impulse, and I use great in a laudatory sense, like one great impulse is let's upzone the suburbs, let's sue the suburbs, let's bring diversity to the suburbs, diversity of people, diversity of building types, diversity of opportunity. And the second great impulse is let's make our transit systems work. And so let's build more housing near subway stops. Let's build more housing on major streets where we could add bus rapid transit relatively easily. And it's that second, the pro-transit strategy, that I think, given predominant aesthetic sensibilities, is going to be the one where there's going to be the bigger housing bang for the buck or the less risk of backlash. Another thing that some cities are pursuing, and I think is an interesting idea and very much worth doing, is the idea of pre-approved designs. Mm-hmm. So if you can take a bunch of like fourplex designs or ADU designs or kind of standard form building types and think about where in the city those standard form building types would work financially for developers, and then come up with a variety of different approaches and vet them, or variety of different designs, I should say, and vet them with a random sample of people from your city, find the ones people like, and then say to builders, hey, if you want to use one of these designs, it's off the rack, it's an automatic permit. And maybe there's some things that the builder can vary, like facade details, but the basic structure is a cookie cutter structure that people like. Mm-hmm. I think that is broadly promising. And then a third idea is to ask, like, what are the conditions under which developers themselves have incentives to care about aesthetics? Mm-hmm. And I think developers will care about aesthetics more where developers own more contiguous lots or larger chunks of land. And you can see some evidence of this anecdotally, like in San Francisco, one of the big developments recently is so-called Mission Rock development. It's a large chunk of land next to the Giants Stadium. And the architect commissioned the builder can commission these four world-class architects to design four trophy buildings. And they work together. The four architects work together. So the buildings are in conversation with one another. They're beautiful buildings. There's a great waterfront park connection. And this is clearly a case where the developer is able to internalize the positive spillovers from these nice buildings in the waterfront park and into rents for other parts of the project. You can also see projects like California Forever, this proposal to build a new city in the middle of nowhere. They're thinking a lot about design, about public green spaces, about how the buildings are going to relate to each other. Efforts to facilitate land assembly and mm-hmm. redevelopment at more of a block or larger scale rather than one-off individual lots may be a way to induce developers to pay more attention to aesthetics. Obviously,
big developers are better. Love it.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a really horrible history of city planners having mm-hmm. ideas about ugly neighborhoods, right? It was yeah. called blight. And there's a tool used to facilitate large-scale redevelopment called eminent domain. Mm-hmm. And this model of development has a really ugly history. So I don't think we want to revert back to 1960s style, quote, slum clearance. But I think there's a reason to be thinking more proactively about land assembly and larger scale developments as a positive thing for urban fabrics.
So I want to go through each of those because I think that there are parts of that which, you know, I feel very cross-pressured on for various reasons. So on your first one, right, about this idea that we should really focus on transit-oriented development or developing up in industrial areas or in commercial areas where there's not, predominantly single-family homes and, you know, apartment buildings might look like out of touch with what the existing aesthetics are. As you sort of already kind of implied, this has some, like, you know, equity concerns. And there's, like, many people inside of the YIMBY movement, including myself. I mean, one of the big motivating factors for me was particularly the research coming out of Rod Chetty's lab around moving to opportunity and how, you know, there are all of these kids who are growing up in very low income communities. And that quite literally, if you change nothing but just moving them to a lower poverty place, that would just have massive impacts on their long-term life outcomes. Like, you're not changing anything about who their parents are. You're not changing anything about, like, how, you know, how wealthy they are, except for obviously, like, you know, you've given them rental vouchers. They could go live in that community. You're not changing anything about, like, their fundamental background, et cetera. And you are able to have this huge impact on incarceration rates of these children, whether they're going to college, their long-term health, their median income as an adult. I mean, and it's really interesting, like, it's very, very concentrated on, like, young children, moving kids when they're very young. And you don't see as much of an effect, if at all, in older kids or in the adults themselves. And so to me, like, who is, like, I mean, I think most people find it, like, very, very unfair that, like, young kids can be born into a neighborhood through no fault of their own. And, like, their entire life could be determined by that fact, or largely determined by that fact. And, you know, we see this research and it's, like, quite a simple fix. Like, if you were to able to give people rental vouchers that were essentially just cash and make them more generous, you could just move people to these areas. But it's also very hard to do this if there aren't units in these areas that are even close to being affordable to these people. Like, even if you gave, I mean, you'd have to give people maybe like, you know, 15x the amount that you are giving them right now to afford an existing unit in a low poverty area. But if you built a bunch of housing, particularly apartment buildings, then there actually are a lot of opportunities for them to be able to use either rental vouchers or themselves be able to afford living in those places for themselves and their families. And motivated by that research, I think a lot of YIMBYs were like, okay, yes, obviously we want a lot more supply. It's great. We should get it wherever we can get it. But, like, it is independently important that, like, in low poverty communities, we are putting new housing. So, like, is this this is one of the things I'm just wrestling. I don't think there's, like, an answer here, but I don't know how you wrestle with this problem.
So I wrestle with it too. Like, it's, you know, it's a real hard one for me. Cause I read that same research. It's super important. It's had a big influence on my thinking. I guess the way I think about it is that there are other ways to facilitate, more subtle forms of diversification and integration of suburbs and suburban school districts, right? So one tool is form-based zoning, right? So you limit the structure to something that looks like a single family home or the existing, or maybe can be one story taller than the existing single family homes. There's actually a pretty cool body of work that was done with pretty small samples. So I don't want to put too much credence in it, but it's interesting and I think worth replicating that this was work done in, like, the 1990s that suggests that people, like, really don't care about new buildings that are taller than existing buildings nearby until the new buildings are more than 1.5 times as tall as the existing building. So if you're in, like, a two-story neighborhood of homes, building a three-story homes, nobody's going to care about that. At least if the style is roughly similar. So having kind of a form-based zone that allows one story taller than the existing homes and requires the facades to be, like, or the silhouettes to be similar to the existing homes, like, you could probably facilitate some apartment development or some small condo development in ways that people would not react to in the same way they react to like a boxy apartment building in a neighborhood of peak roofed single family homes. Second, many of those suburbs have some major street or some commercial area. And so long as people who live in that commercial area or along the major street are in the same school district, I think you could probably get a lot of the moving to opportunity benefits from upzoning those areas, even if the single family home areas are not upzoned. And then third, we know from a bunch of great new research that allowing hedge funds to buy up single family homes may not be popular with our current president, but does actually increase rental housing supply, right? And it raises home values. So in a sense, it's like the win-win policy for homeowners. If you're a true home voter, you should welcome the hedge funds to your neighborhoods because they are going to drive up your home values at the same time that they're going to increase the number of single family homes that are available to rent. Mm-hmm. And then those single family homes that are rented can be rented either by people who don't have the down payment for a home, but maybe have young kids and they want to be in a good school district, or people who get an opportunity voucher, like a moving to opportunity voucher. Last thing I'll say is there's a big problem with voucher programs now, which is that they're underfunded, and many of the people, particularly in supply constrained markets, who get a voucher don't match with a unit. And there's an awesome study that came out of that Chetty et al. Lab on tenant and landlord counseling, showing that counseling programs that explain how you can use your voucher in these high opportunity neighborhoods and connect to tenants who may be demoralized about the idea of searching in those neighborhoods to landlords who are open to it. And then similarly, counseling landlords on here's how the program works. Here's why it might be advantageous to actually have a tenant who you know isn't going to default because they've got a tenant voucher. These counseling programs, while not cheap, had massive effects on moving to opportunity and really demonstrated that the lack of take up of that moving to opportunity program is not because of like tenants' desire to stay in neighborhoods with, quote, more people like them. Poor tenants desire to stay in neighborhoods with more people like them, but their lack of information about how to get to a different neighborhood.
Yeah. On the second one around this idea of pre-approved designs, I mean, like, I think that there have been really great people like Alfred Twu, for instance, who have thought about illustrating how beautiful multifamily housing can really be. Like, I've walked through the Nashville neighborhoods where you see these fourplexes that are actually, like, almost indistinguishable unless you know exactly what things to look for from the single family homes in those neighborhoods. I'm like not opposed to any of that, and that's great. But I think like at a larger scale, what we're often talking about is like raising the cost of construction, because if it was the same or less expensive to build homes in a prettier style, I just think that like developers would probably just do that already. There maybe are ways that, you know, having a pre-approved design would change things because it gives certainty to a developer that they'll get a permit or something like that. But like, I'm a little bit worried about spending too much effort on this and potentially just raising costs even more.
Yeah, I mean, it does raise costs. But I'm at least open to the idea that having design competitions where projects are, or designs are rated both on their attractiveness and on their economic feasibility could be an interesting and useful strategy. And if the design increases costs, but it also increases the value of neighboring developments, then like it may actually be something that facilitates development rather than thwarting it. So if you're looking at greenfield suburban development, most of those developments take the form of common interest communities with a homeowner association and with some guidelines about design that are regulated by the homeowners association, right? And that's some evidence that people are willing to pay more for housing in places where there is design regulation.
Yeah. Well, I'm team ban HOAs, so I know that's That's like now I mean, I see these like underrated how much HOAs are going to end up defining the politics of NIMBYism.
Well, let's maybe we can start with banning HOA restrictions on rentals of the homes in the HOAs, which
I
would
just actually
serve the
think
opportunity
HOAs,
goal without preventing HOAs from doing their design regulation.
I just think that, like, I don't know, as someone who had an HOA in my neighborhood growing up, like, I just think these things are actually quite unpopular in like a story sense. But then when you actually look at how people, like, there are very many people who actually like will opt into HOA communities, and I can't tell if it's just because they can't find the house that they want in a non-HOA community. But that level of like control from like a non-governmental body to me just feels like so anti-American. I can't believe people are okay with this.
Well, it's clearly pro-American by revealed preference, but there is a paper that tries to estimate whether HOAs actually increase the value of the homes in the HOA. And again, it's not a perfect design. You're not randomizing the assignment of homes to an HOA or not an HOA, but the finding of the paper is that during their first 3 to 4 decades of life, HOAs do increase the value of the homes in the HOA. And once the HOA is 4 decades old, it's not adding value, maybe decreasing value. So maybe those design guidelines the developer came up with originally were working, but then it becomes out of date and the busybodies take over and the whole thing is a fiasco or at least a wash. And so really, I think as a policy matter, what we should be doing is sunsetting HOA restrictions, probably rather
I
than
know this is the
preventing them from.
sensible take, but you will never catch me living in an HOA community, Chris. I just want you to know
Do you
that.
live in a condo?
No, I rent
Okay.
I rent right now a townhouse, so it's much better, let me tell you.
Okay.
No
Because condos
problems.
are also
Also,
HOAs, but
I know I don't have this problem.
yeah.
I mean, I actually think that, like, I mean, my husband probably will want to try it, like, is not so opposed to home ownership, and I'm like, you would have to kill me like to get me to own a house or
So
to
you're
live in
gonna
an HOA
instead own a
community.
single family home like on a
No, I'll just
farm?
rent. I'll just rent forever.
All
We won't deal with it.
right.
Well, I think this is a great place to get to our last and final question, Chris, which is, what is an argument that you have heard recently that you disagreed with? And this can be anything from a book you read that you didn't like very much to an article or take that you disliked to, advice you received.
So I'm gonna stay in the housing space with this one. And I'm
Okay.
normally a pretty mild-mannered guy, and there's not a lot of things that really get me riled up. And most arguments that I disagree with, I can at least understand where they're coming from. Like, well, I get your premises, and I think you're wrong, but I'm not really that mad at you about being wrong. But I am actually mad about people being wrong about one thing, and that is coupling rent control with vacancy control. So rent control laws typically restrict the amount the landlord can raise the rent on an existing tenant. So you may have a 1-year lease, but if you're under a rent control law, you would have the right to renew that lease, and the landlord would be capped at maybe rate of inflation plus some increment as to how much they can raise the rent. And in fact, a few years ago, you wrote a great paper that maybe had an overexuberant title about like how I came to love rent control. That was really more like how I made my peace, sort of, with rent control.
I think it was how I
But
changed my mind about
okay,
rent control.
sorry, I'm misrecollecting. But like you're like rent control laws actually do protect tenants from big shocks that could come from sudden increases in demand and supply responds more slowly. And people do have this reliance interest in these connections to a community. And so like maybe rent control laws, we know rent control laws have actually a lot of bad effects on incentives for development and misallocation of existing units, like single person ending up like tottering around in their big old house or big old apartment that could be a family apartment or something. But they have these other benefits too. And those benefits are maybe worth taking seriously. But you can have those benefits, all of those benefits, while still allowing the landlord to reset the rent to market when the existing tenant moves out. And if you allow the landlord to reset the rent to market when the existing tenant moves out, that greatly reduces the distortionary effect of the rent control law because it creates an arrangement where the landlord could actually bargain with the tenant to move out if the rental value has increased a lot and the tenant has some other opportunity. It also gives the landlord a reason not to discriminate on the basis of race or any other arbitrary characteristic when they're renting a unit that has turned over that's now vacant. If they can control the price, they're going to rent to whoever is a good tenant who can pay the price. If they can't control the price, what are they going to do instead? I don't know, rent to Sydney Sweeney, you know, or just choose people on the basis of their genes. I don't know. Like, right. Like that's really, that's not the world we want to be in, right? Where the price of privately owned units is set way below market and the landlord can rent them to whomever they want, so long as they rent them at that super low price. Yeah. And yet, despite vacancy control being this obviously really horrible idea, you have every progressive organization in California pushing for it with three ballot initiatives over the last decade, all of which were defeated, but with hundreds of millions of dollars spent in opposition. And you now have all the progressive groups, including labor unions in Massachusetts, lining up behind a statewide ballot measure to impose really strict rent control with vacancy controls across the state of Massachusetts. So, like, I just want to see, like, that like reasonable rent control advocate out there somewhere saying, look, I'm just trying to protect the interest of the existing tenants. I'm not trying to destroy the housing market. I'm not trying to, like, crush investment in new rental properties. I'm not trying to encourage landlords to discriminate on the basis of race or other arbitrary characteristics. And the only argument that the vacancy control proponents are able to come up with is that if we don't have vacancy control, like, landlords are going to pressure existing tenants to move out.
Yeah.
But, like, that's just the flip side of landlords, like, offering existing tenants money to move out.
Yes.
And if you're an existing tenant, like, being offered money to move out and having that choice is better than stuck in your existing below market rate rental, but without the opportunity to take a chunk of change and move somewhere else that works better for you, better for the landlord, and better for the would-be future tenant of the building.
Yeah. And I mean, like, there's some historical research about, you know, landlords doing kind of, like, insane stuff to tenants when they were trying to get them to move out. But I'm just like, this sort of thing is like, if you're seeing a landlord, like, threatening someone, like, the way that you solve that problem is through, like, legal action. You don't solve, like, someone who's committing crimes by, like, oh, well, let's not even make it possible for, like, any other person to make money. Like, that's just, like, not how we operate in any other context.
You punish landlords to do that. I'm totally on board with rent registries and buyer registries so that, like, you solve the asymmetric information problem between landlords who know the value of a unit turning over versus the tenant not knowing what a buyer would be worth. But this, like, group of people who are dead set on imposing vacancy controls, like, that is just crazy, crazy wrong.
It's symbolic politics, Chris. Back to the beginning.
Landlords
well, thanks
are
so much
bad.
For yeah, exactly. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. This was fantastic.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. Take care.